I want to talk about where life flourishes today. Because sometimes it flourishes where it just doesn't make sense. Where we look at the situation, we look at the math, we look at how we would calculate our survival odds, and where we expect life not to flourish is exactly where it flourishes. When all the odds are against it, when it shouldn't, but it does. And as we are called into a relationship with God, we're all going to go through these periods. This period where we're in a place to where life shouldn't flourish, but if we cleave and align to Him, it does. But it shouldn't. Not by human standards. You know, if we think about our life and kind of the way it works, we frequently in parts of our life we come to a crossroad. And just kind of I've got a couple of images here, just the images I created with artificial intelligence, so no copyrights involved. Just say that to kind of get it out there. But we're often led where we come to a crossroads and in our life, and we have to make a choice. And we're trying to evaluate. We can't see that far. We can see a little ways. We can't see far enough down the road. That's one of the problems with being a human. One of the challenges, quite frankly, that our Father doesn't have. He knows the ends from the beginning. He knows how everything is going to work out. He has the ability to guide the events in our life. He says He will do that, ultimately for our good, that He is going to make sure that we're in His family, and He is going to be the one that engages so that our path is straight and that we walk the path and we stay with Him. But we come to crossroads in our life. And sometimes we do the math with regard to what path should I take. And it's sometimes when we're evaluating that path, it doesn't seem to work. Both paths seem okay, and then we get a little bit further down, and we get close, and lo and behold, there's a Bigfoot. Some kind of barrier that we have to deal with. And logic would tell you that's probably not the path you want to go on if you want to stay alive. Take the other path. The survival math tells you, don't go that direction. But frequently with God, that's the direction He wants you to go. And that's where life is going to flourish. But it doesn't seem like it. It seems scary. It seems hard. It seems difficult. I mean, if we look at the people of God throughout history, they've encountered these. They've encountered this crossroad. I remember growing up in the church as I was a young person, you would hear the stories about people that gave up their job for the Sabbath. They had a crossroad. Work on the Sabbath or don't work. Logic would tell you, survival logic, see if you can work a little bit. See if you can work it out. God's logic would say, follow me. That's where life is. Not an easy choice, especially if you have a family, if you have dependents, if you're working on a career. Those are really hard choices to make. And we're all going to have those choices. I want to look at a story today of an individual who had a crossroad. And as I was telling my wife this morning, I've come to many crossroads on this sermon. It started one direction, then it went another, and then finally it comes here. Must have changed 40 times during the time that I was writing it. Maybe not 40, probably 5 or 6, but it felt like 40 when I was developing it. One of the things that was really interesting, as I was thinking about this, and I was thinking about the people that we see in the Bible who came to these crossroads periods where the survival math didn't work, we see characteristics that are common. Now, every situation doesn't have every characteristic, but they share a lot of these characteristics. The story that we're going to look at, that we're going to dig in today, shares these characteristics. First characteristic that we find: faith generally has to be exercised in adverse circumstances. When you choose the path, you don't always know the outcome. And as human beings, we want to know the outcome. I want to make sure that if I get on this road, it's going to be okay, and I'm going to get to my destination okay. But when you get on the road, you have to stay loyal to the one that established the path. You're caught in a circumstance where you have to have faith in adverse circumstances. When we come to crossroads in our life, it's generally a dire situation. Frequently, the individual is at a low point, or they're in a situation that's going to lead to a difficulty, maybe harm, maybe death. You think about Abraham going up to Mount Moriah. What's it like to travel the path with the intention to sacrifice your child? Because that was the path. Really hard. It frequently occurs in a situation where what is being asked to do, just it seems illogical. The survival math would tell us not to follow God, not to do that. I mean, if I'm just looking from a human perspective, it's like, don't go down the path with Bigfoot. He's bigger and stronger than you. Stay off the path. This situations oftentimes involve a system that failed. The example we're going to see today involves a system that failed. And in this situation, it was one where the covenant community, the people that God was working with, failed in their responsibility. And it had massive impacts in the land. In these situations, it seems like you're alone. Like there is nobody else there. Like you have to make this decision and you wonder, is anybody else see? Does anybody else care? But God's still watching. He's still there. We see that in this story we're going to look at. And then it requires an action, a giving of a first portion, a step out in faith, a movement, an inverted order. You're in a situation and you have to follow God first, even though everything else cries out around you and it says, not a good idea. But you still do it. And we follow ourselves second. We look after ourselves second. So in the story I want to look at today, it's the widow of Zarephath. When Elijah was confronting Ahab and Jezebel, in 1 Kings we see a story of a lady who walked this path. And it's a fascinating story. One of the most fascinating things about the story and the lady is we don't even know her name. We know where she lived. What was left on account, what was left for us to see, were her actions, were her commitment. The commitment that she had to God. What's even more fascinating? She wasn't even an Israelite. She wasn't a part of the covenant community. But she walked the path. She came to the crossroad. So we'll start in 1 Kings 17. We'll create a little context here as we get into it, because I think sometimes it's good to take a step back and try to think about the grittiness of the situation that we read when we read about people in the Bible, because it's easy at times to read the stories in the Bible. We're sitting in a comfortable chair. We've got a cup of coffee. We've got a nice, cool drink. We're inside, we're outside, where it's comfortable, and we're reading it, and we don't see the intensity and the pain and the grittiness and the challenge of the situation. And it's easy to look at some of these circumstances these people are in and just kind of walk through them and not stop to really think and try to experience, where were they? It's not just words on a page. These are lives. This was her life. 1 Kings chapter 17, beginning in verse 8. Then the word of the Lord came to him, Elijah, saying, "Arise and go to Zarephath, which belongs to Sidon, and dwell there. See, I have commanded a widow there to provide for you." So he does. So he arose and he went to Zarephath. And when he came to the gate of the city, indeed, a widow was there gathering sticks. And he called to her and said, "Please bring me a little water in a cup that I may drink." And as she was going to get it, he called after her and said, "Please bring me a little morsel of bread in your hand." Now, pretty innocuous request, seemingly. I mean, we probably know the story pretty well. But let's create a little bit of the context that was going on. It's kind of interesting. So Ahab and Jezebel had introduced Baal into the court. She was hunting down the priests of God, the prophets, the believers. So the priests of Baal had taken over. We see in chapter 18, where they're confronted with Elijah, but the holy people are scared, they're running. Jezebel is a very powerful individual. Ahab is completely aligned. If we consider Sidon, Jezebel's father was the king of Sidon, a very powerful individual. They worship Baals. Now, I say Baals because when we get to the Ugaritic, Baals means lord or master, not necessarily a god, but a lord or master. So there is another god that had been set up. Now, when we think about it's interesting to think, so scholars will argue, but it's one of the gods in the Sidon pantheon was Baal Shemem. And he was the god of storms. So he's the one that of lightning and thunder and rain. And it's interesting that it was the rain that God stopped. And I wonder if that wasn't also a message to Jezebel and Ahab of who really had power. Baal Shemem had no power to stop the rain. God did. Could have been other gods, there was a pantheon of gods. Could have been another, but I think it's interesting to think about. Ahab had announced a three-year drought, and they were nearing the end of it. We see that coming up in 1 Kings 18:1. But what's interesting, when we look at some of Josephus' writings in the antiquity, during this time, the drought didn't just impact Israel. It was a surrounding community. So think about this for a second. When we think about the power of sin in the community, and the blast radius that sin has, it wasn't just Israel who was turning their back on God, who deviated from the path. It wasn't just Israel that was struggling. It was the land around them. The covenant people had failed. The covenant community had failed in their responsibility. This is the situation that the widow was in. She had no responsibility for this coming on the people, but she was impacted by it. The other thing that's interesting, when you think about the whole situation, God had been preparing for Elijah all along. First, he fed Elijah by ravens at the brook of Cherith until it dried up. But then God makes a statement when he's talking to Elijah. I think this is a really interesting statement. And I want you to, one of the things that we're going to find, and we're going to get to it here in a couple of slides, the term covenant is never used with a widow at Zarephath. But the whole story drips with covenant language, with oath-like language, with commitment, with provision. And here, God had been preparing, and it says that he commanded this widow. God found this widow in Zarephath and was going and had connected with her, not Israel, not of the land of the covenant people, where he chose. The other interesting thing about it, that the phrasing in the Hebrew is perfect tense. So it intimates this idea that the work with her, the work that he was doing with her, was already done. So what God didn't tell Elijah, well, when you go there, I'm going to find somebody. No, God had already found her. He knew her. He chose her. And now we're going to see, we will see shortly, her fork in the road, her commitment to God, her growing recognition of who and what he was, is. But think about her situation. Right, so she was Sidonian. Zarephath was ruled by Sidon. You think about for a widow at that time, so there were laws in Israel that helped protect widows and orphans, even though the people didn't always keep the laws. There was nothing in Phoenicia, the Phoenicians, in Sidon. There was no type of safety net. The widow was on her own with her son. Her son was her future. He, you know, her hope was that he would grow up, become a man, and then she would be protected in the household and cared for. She found herself in a place where there was nothing left to hope for. She was out gathering twigs, and it's really interesting. Same terminology when Israel was out gathering the stubble for making the mud bricks in Egypt. She was at the end. She had a couple, she was going to get just enough to make one last meal for herself, a meager meal for herself and her son, And then her plan was to simply die. No future, no hope. So what do you think about that? Just take a step back. For almost 3 years, there's been no rain. You have no hope. You have nobody protecting you. You are on your own. You were there with your son, whom you've raised from the time that he was little. And you were watching your son come to his end as well. That's where she was. Terrible place. That's the context that God reaches out to her in. Continuing. So she said, "As the Lord your God lives, I don't have any bread. Only a handful. Think about that. A widow's handful. That's not a big loaf of bread. That's a little bit. Only a handful of flour in a bin and a little oil in a jar. And see, I am gathering a couple of sticks." It doesn't even take that many sticks. "That I may go in and prepare it for myself and my son, that we may eat it and die." Our hope is exhausted. And Elijah said to her, fascinating statement, "Do not fear. Go and do as you have said, but make me a little cake from it first and bring it to me, and afterward make some for yourself and your son. For thus says the Lord God of Israel, the bin of flour shall not be used up, nor shall the jar of oil run dry until the day the Lord sends rain on the earth." Fascinating interchange from the widow's perspective. So where's she at here in this interaction? Consider the term, "as the Lord your God lives." I think one of the most interesting things that we find in the Bible is this idea of remembrance. Those people who have a covenant relationship with God, those people that he uses to pursue his will, they remember him. It's interesting, if you think back in Jericho and Rahab, when the spies came to Rahab, what did she say? She started talking to them and reciting the great works that God had done as he rescued his people from Egypt. Rahab remembered. She's not the only one. We see remembrance as something that's powerful in the scripture. She remembered, she recognized, and that was before she saw any miracle or sign. The other thing that's really interesting is this phrase, "as the Lord your God lives." It's phrased as an oath. We see this type of phrase in the Hebrew and other places in the Bible, but it's phrased as an oath with God as a surety. And so what she's saying, I know he lives, but this is all I have. I don't have anything else. The other thing that's really interesting, she hasn't gone so far as to claim intimacy or claim connection with God. I remember him. I know, I've heard. Her son and her life hang in the balance. She's at the crossroad. And as we said, her hope was exhausted. So think about God's instruction here for just a second. Where does he start with her? Now, obviously, he's communicating through Elijah, but where does he start with her? Yes, you're at a crossroad. Yes, it may seem ugly, like there is something really scary on the path. but don't fear. Trust. Trust God. Trust Him. Trust that He is sure. Ignore the math. The math doesn't work. The math does not work. She's faced with an illogical choice from the commandment of God, direction of God. Make something for Elijah first, and then yourself and your son. But trust me when you do that. It's fascinating when you think about what God was asking of her. He was asking her to have faith, to have believing loyalty, what the Israelites had rejected. It's interesting to consider her journey here. I want to back up and just look at a little bit of the language, because I think the language here is important. One of the things that you find with God throughout the scriptures, He says over and over and over, I am enough. You don't need another provision. You need me. I am enough. And when we enter into a relationship with Him, He is enough. It doesn't matter what the world does. It doesn't matter what nuclear powers do. It doesn't matter what the Senate or the House of Representatives, none of that matters. He's enough. And we see her start to go through this process. We'll read through here, and we'll look at verses 9, 14, 16, and verse 16. And so I know we've read some of these, but I want to kind of pull some language and terminology out here just a little bit, and look at a little bit more. Let's look at the promise first. So what was He promising her? So as He was coming down and connecting with her and interacting and developing a relationship, He gave her a promise. And His promise, He made two promises. One, that the flour would not be used up, it wouldn't be exhausted. That comes from the Hebrew kalah. And it means it won't come to an end, it won't be exhausted. So the promise that God gives her, what you would expect to happen with that flour, won't happen. Again, I'm enough. What you would normally expect for that flour to be used up is not going to happen, because you're engaging with me now. I'm not like the gods of Sidon and Tyre. I am different, and the outcome is different. The other thing that we see is He tells her that the oil won't run out. It won't run dry. And that is the Hebrew chaser. It's fascinating. It's the same terminology that's used in Psalm 23. Yea, though I walk through the valley of death, I shall not want, I shall not lack. The other interesting thing that we get a view to here is more than just a simple promise from God saying, you're going to have oil and you're going to have flour. Behind this statement, we start from a context of what we see in verses, in chapter 17, verse 9. It says, arise, go to Zarephath, see, I have commanded a widow there to provide for you. That term provide is really interesting. Can be translated sustain. It can be translated other words. But when it is used in the context of God providing for His people, or one of His agents executing His judgments in the context, it frequently refers to provision. That can be used in other terminologies. But what we see here is this covenant type relationship where God is reaching out. He has chosen this woman. He is asking her to step out on faith and believe that he is God and believe that he will reward, but she has to act. Faith, believing loyalty requires action. We can't just sit. The path looks scary. We still need to walk the path. Not just a statement. It's the texture of a covenant relationship with God that we're seeing. It's the intimacy, it's the commitment that he has. Now let's shift focus again. Come back to verse 15. What did she do? So she went away and did according to the word of Elijah, following the commandment of God. And she and he and her household ate for many days. The bin of flour was not used up, nor did the jar of oil run dry, according to the word of the Lord, which he spoke by Elijah. So you think about this growing relationship. God chose her. Elijah shows up. She's left at a crossroad, at a fork in the road. She has to choose. She has heard God by the hearing of the ear. I know that he lives. I get it. But will you go down the path? Will she? It's interesting when we look at this, she went and we did. When you look at that Hebrew, and it's not a consistent construction, but when we look at the actions of Noah and of Abraham and of Moses, you find similar statements. They all acted. Linguistic construction, but you find a lot of similarities in the way that the statements are made about what those individuals did. And that's what she did. The Sidonian, not a part of the covenant people. She took a step on faith and she began deepening her connection to God. What was God's response? Everything that happened was according to his word and his power. Not Elijah, not some Sidonian god. He proves to her in that situation that he is enough. She doesn't need kings and princes. Not only that, he sustains life where the math doesn't add up. Now, if you go outside her house, the math doesn't add up. And you think about that. Think about other parallels where God is working. Think about the Garden of Eden, this lush place where life is flourishing. You go out, it's hard. It's difficult. But where she was at, because of what she had done, because of God's selection, because of the relationship, life flourished there where it shouldn't have. And she knew it. She was ready to die. What a statement. What about God's perspective of his commitment? I think it's really interesting. So you think about, and again, we just take a step out, right? Just take a step out for just a minute, and we kind of reset where we're at. So Israel had gone off track. They were killing the prophets. They were killing the priests. Elijah was on the run. And he finds this lady, not involved in any of this stuff, just trying to exist. It's interesting to consider his commitment. So I'm going to look at something that I think is really interesting that God says. I think we can draw a parallel here. Isaiah 49. So Israel's gone into captivity. It says, but Zion said, the Lord has forsaken me and the Lord has forgotten me. The people had been dispersed and they thought, they were wondering, do you even remember who we are? So I want you to think about this from your perspective. Have you ever been in a place where you're at the crossroads and you wonder, are you even there? It's really hard right now. This hurts. I don't like this place. I'm not sure. Are you there? Can you hear me? Do you see my pain? Do you see where I'm at? Have you ever been in that place? This is God's response. Can a woman forget her nursing child, that she should have no compassion on the son of her womb? Even these may forget, yet I will not forget you. Now, this is a fascinating statement. Behold, on the palms of my hand, I have engraved you. Your walls are continually before me. Now, what's really interesting about this, Zion frequently refers to the covenant community, those who God has a relationship with. He doesn't forget. As we look at what Isaiah is saying, Isaiah tells what a covenant commitment feels like with God. Sometimes we're on the path, we can forget this. But with him, it is engraved, it is never forgotten, and it is more permanent than a mother's love. If you think about where the widow was, and her vulnerability and her weakness, that's what she was experiencing. That's what we experience. What's really interesting now is to see her evolution and her continued connection to God. I read through this. I think it's really interesting just to think about what's going on with her and even what's led up to this place. She's seen his power. She heard of him. She's seen his power. She knows that he is unique and different. Verse 17, now it happened after these things that the son of the woman who owned the house became sick. And the sickness was so serious that there was no breath left in him. So she said to Elijah, what have I to do with you, O man of God? Have you come to me to bring my sin to remembrance and to kill my son? This path is really hard. Things are happening that I don't understand. And he said to her, give me your son. So he took him out of her arms and carried him up to the upper room where he was staying and laid him on his own bed. Then he cried out to the Lord and said, O Lord, my God, have you also brought tragedy on the widow with whom I lodge by killing her son? Of course God didn't. But you know, when we get in these situations, when we're walking that path, sometimes we can allow ourselves to get a little confused. And he stretched himself out on the child three times and cried out to the Lord and said, O Lord, my God, I pray, let this child's soul come back to him, referring to his breath. Then the Lord heard the voice of Elijah, and the soul or the breath of the child came back to him, and he revived. And Elijah took the child and brought him down from the upper room into the house and gave him to his mother. And Elijah said, see, your son lives. And then what did she say to Elijah? Now by this I know you are a man of God, and the word of the Lord in your mouth is the truth. You know, if you think back upon Job, what did Job say at the end in verse in chapter 42? Paraphrasing, I thought I heard you, right? I've heard you by the hearing of the ear. I thought I knew, but now I see you. Powerful statement. Think about her journey. What does she go through? She had to have faith in adverse circumstances. She was in a dire situation. She was asked to do something that was completely illogical. She was impacted by a system that failed. The covenant people failed, and it wreaked havoc in the land. The blast radius was huge. I'm not positive that anybody that was going through the town of Zarephath would have even noticed her. And again, one of the things that I was originally planning to do with this message got a little too long. I would encourage you to do it in your own time. I would encourage you to parallel this versus the woman at the treasury that gives the widow's mite. There is a shocking parallel between those two stories. There's two small coins that she gives. Shocking parallel. Nobody else might have seen her, but when the widow went to give her offering, she was drowned out in the cacophony. But it was Christ who saw her. And then she gave the first portion. She stood out in faith. And life flourished. So what about us? So when we think about God and our engagement with Him, we think about what He asked us to do. We're all going to come to the fork in the road. It's absolutely guaranteed. You will come to a fork in a road, and probably many times. What kind of math do we use? Do we look at survival math? Do we calculate our chances? Do we see if there's some big, ugly thing standing on the path that's going to hurt me? Or do we look at God's logic of life? As we leave here, what is our fork?